Thank you again for attending the 2018 Texas Chapters Conference. This is our fourth annual statewide conference of the lawyers and students chapters of the Federalist Society, but this is the first inaugural Gregory Coleman Lecture. And we are blessed to have Judge Edith Jones to introduce our first lecturer in that series. Edith Jones has been a federal judge since May 1985. She assumed her judgeship in October 2012. She was born in Pennsylvania, but actually raised in San Antonio, graduating from Alamo Heights High School. So she is a Texan who wasn't born here, but got here as quick as she could. She received her BA in economics from Cornell, graduating with honors. And I'm happy to report that she is a graduate of the University of Texas Law School, as are many in this room. So we're welcoming one of our own here in Fort Worth. This lecture series is designed to commemorate the life and career of Texas's first Solicitor General, Gregory S. Coleman. The speakers that you will hear today knew Greg Coleman. I was not ever fortunate enough to work with him, but if you ask around and you use that name, you will hear stories of a wonderful life, well lived. This room is filled with his friends. We are grateful for you being here for this inaugural event. And without further ado, I will hand the microphone to Judge Jones.
You know, on the appeals court, we don't get much of an opportunity to speak, so I have to restrain myself from just going. I could talk to a wall for an hour, but you're not a wall, and I don't think you want to hear me for an hour. I could talk about Greg Coleman for quite a long time as well. I'm very honored to be at this occasion to inaugurate the Gregory S. Coleman Lecture Series for the Federalist Society. Greg was an early and avid member of the Federalist Society, and one of the women at dinner last night was saying that she was one of the first, he was one of the first people that she met in Washington at a FedSoc when she was just hired by the FedSoc, and what a nice fellow he was and what a great impression he had made. So I want to start out by asking a question of you all. How many of you personally remember the Robert Bork confirmation hearings? How many of you were not even born during the Robert Bork confirmation? Well, that's fewer than I would have thought, but what this reveals is that this is a very young audience, and this is what the Federalist Society has done. It has inspired going on two generations of lawyers who didn't find a sympathetic traditionalist voice in the law schools and given coherence and an opportunity to debate and think about the important issues that face us as a nation in the legal world. So I'm so proud that we have five new judges on our court. In fact, they've raised the bar for the Fifth Circuit since I got on, since most of them are here, all but one of them are here today. And that's thanks to the Federalist Society, to Leonard, to Jean, who's in the audience, and to the rest of the governing group here. So I thank them first of all. I thank Stephanie and Reed Coleman for coming. Stephanie was Greg's wife. Reed, one of his three sons, all of whom have been very successful. I'm told that Reed has about a half dozen, he's in his first semester of law school, he has about a half dozen clerkship offers already. But they used to, when I had hired Greg as a law clerk, he was just like anybody else. I mean, he was an Aggie. I took that into consideration. He had an MBA. He had excelled at the University of Texas School of Law. And he had a very serious work ethic. So he would be at the office around 7:30 in the morning. He would work a full day. Basically, that's not the way most law clerks are accustomed to working when they get into the court, because they think this is the easy year before they go out into the real world. But Greg did amazing work. He was clearly a brilliant lawyer. He was ambitious, but he was also extremely self-effacing, had a great sense of humor, participated in all kinds of activities with his boys. And in fact, during the year that he clerked for me, even though the boys were toddlers, they used to play with our old kids' toys when they came to our house, he was already in charge of a Boy Scout troop for the LDS church, and he was very active as a member of the church. He was modest. He, you know, put family first, and as you all know, he put the welfare of the country on as high a plane as his professional well-being, and litigated many, many important cases. He inaugurated the position of Solicitor General of the state of Texas, which has had a very distinguished number of alumni since then, and they set up a fellowship in his name just a year or two ago. I could talk about Greg for a long time, but I think I'd rather talk about his legacy. His death was incredibly shocking to all of us who loved him. But in addition to Lisa at dinner last night, remembering him at his memorial service in Austin, a bunch of the New Haven firefighters came down, because that year not only did he argue the case that would set the stage to talk about Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, the Mudd case, he also had defended the New Haven firefighters in a claim about affirmative action gone awry. And they were so touched by his representation, they came down to the memorial service. He befriended people who were opposite him in cases, one of whom was a lady in the Justice Department who worked in the voting rights section. And later on, she was responsible for sending Greg over to Iraq as a representative of American lawyers over there, and she facilitated my visit to Iraq, all of that because of her admiration for Greg Coleman. As you talk to anybody in the audience who ever came into contact with Greg, and you will realize what a long and lively legacy he has held. And I can't mention all of his activities, but he did teach a con law seminar at the University of Texas that has also become sort of a model for later state solicitors general to be in to handle. And let me move on now, though, to his other boss, no doubt much more significant mentor, Justice Thomas. And I start off with a very briefly by saying, I remember at one of the very early FedSoc meetings, Professor Paul Bator from the University of Chicago gave a pep talk, or spoke about a pep talk he would give each year to the students, that you have to love the law. And it is very difficult to love the law for a number of reasons. It's challenging, it's dry, it's not a matter of passion. A lot of it is a matter of intellectual rigor. But he said, and you know, I've now been on the bench a long time, and I figured out, well, you go to the office every day, and you work on the law, and eventually one hopes it works on you. Greg Coleman loved the law. He had a tremendous enthusiasm for life and tremendous diligence, and he never stopped learning. And with that, I will say, that characterizes our friend Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas wanted me to emphasize Greg and not him, but I've got to speak about three things that will tell you what you need to know about Justice Thomas. First of all, read his autobiography, My Grandfather's Son. You will find that it is a dramatic, intellectually honest portrayal of the adversity that he faced in his youth, some errors that he made, many lessons that he learned, and it is a tribute to his grandfather and to what we call the American work ethic and diligence and the opportunities that this country offers to people that are always at risk. Second, I will refer to a book that my friend Professor Ralph Rossum at Claremont University wrote called Understanding Clarence Thomas, The Jurisprudence of Constitutional Reconstruction. And it goes over his opinions as of until a couple of years ago, when his quarter century on the bench, showing the systematic intellectual rigor, the fearlessness in going back to the original principles, saying we're bound by the Constitution, no matter what some erroneous intervening court decisions have said, and the influence that he has steadily wielded. Professor Ross amends that book by saying he's a marathon runner whose stamina has only been growing over his career on the court. In the magazine City Journal, Myron Magnet, a well-known social commentator, has wrote a two-part piece called His Grandfather's Son, Clarence Thomas's Quest for a New Birth of Freedom. And Magnet makes the same kind of observations about the influence that Justice Thomas has had intellectually on the development of the law. And then finally, of course, my favorite Justice Thomas principle law of law is any fool would know, right? which had to do with sentencing rules, where the Supreme Court has had this tendency to think very hard about very small things, and any fool would know that sentencing is an art and not a precise science. But I close with this. Clarence Thomas is the most important legal thinker in America. The oft-misunderstood justice has single-handedly reshaped the way conservatives think about the law. The article points out that 20% of the Trump nominees to the courts of appeals have been Clarence Thomas law clerks, which is a very impressive record. The article contrasts the approaches of Justice Scalia and Thomas, and for reasons that you will see, I will not go into that detail, but it ends up by says that whereas Justice Scalia wrote with one particular approach, Justice Thomas has adopted a historical approach based on what the Constitution meant at the time of the founding. And it ends up by saying, for a quarter century now, young members of the Federalist Society have opened up their constitutional law textbooks, read Thomas's solo dissents, and wondered, why not? The oldest of these former students are now in the prime of their careers, ripe for appointment to the federal bench. And there's an entire generation of them waiting for their turn. And the thing says, God help us.
Thank you very much, Judge Jones. And thank you, everybody, for being here today. Before we start, Judge Jones gave a great tribute to Greg Coleman, and I'd like to just ask Stephanie and Reed Coleman to please stand so we can all thank them for being here today. It's great to have you here today.
Well, thank you. You know, Leonard, since you're the number three most powerful person in the world, we have to say.
Right. God help us. God help us. Let me remind everybody also that I think volunteers are going to collect cards. So if you've got a question that has a short question that can be read quickly and has a question mark at the end, just put it on a card. While we're collecting those, let me just get things started. So this week, of course, lots of folks have been paying a little attention to confirmation hearings for Judge Brett Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court. It's in a way symbolic of of the transition of power we have for the Supreme Court. With the benefit of having served both on the court and on the Court of Appeals for a number of years, what do you think is, among the most important qualities that we should have in our judges, and what should people be thinking about and looking for as they consider people who are serving on the bench?
You know, first of all, it's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be with our good friend and member of our clerk family, Stephanie, and all my former law clerks here, and Reed, who should actually be studying property right now. And I think if you want to look at an outstanding quality, what qualities you need, you need to look no further than Judge Jones. I consider her a judicial hero, a heroine, if you want to be gender normative. I, of course, have looked at many of her writings, and you notice two characteristics: the capacity to make decisions, to parse the law, to parse the fact, the work ethic, the intellectual rigor, but you can reach a lot of decisions. That's, to me, as difficult as that can be, it's the easy part of the job. When you get to hard decisions, the second part is more important, and she has this in spades, and that is courage. You've got to have the courage to make the hard decisions that your reasoning leads you to. And she has done that. Just look over her career. Now, it doesn't necessarily make you popular, but I think that one of the things that Judge Silberman wrote about back when I first went on the bench, he called it the greenhouse effect. And he was talking about Linda Greenhouse, and it was a play on words with greenhouse gases. And the greenhouse effect was that you were more concerned about what would be said about you than you were about making the right decision. And the greenhouse effect was you would actually change your opinion to be consistent with the expected opinion from then Linda Greenhouse in the New York Times. So I would say courage is very important.
You know, and when you mentioned the word courage, I mean, Judge Jones and you, of course, come to mind, but also, you know, Greg Coleman came to mind.
Well, that was going to be my second part. I mean, this inaugural lecture, and I'm honored to have been thought of to be a part of that. I remember when Greg, of course, was a phenomenal law clerk, and I remember he and I were working on a little case about the automatic locks on train cars, and none of the other clerks had any interest in it. But I remember Greg and I had stacks of books about train cars and the gauge on train tracks, and it was one of the most fascinating things. But at any rate, Greg said some things. When Greg left to come back to Texas, I remember he came back to Weil Gotshal, and I remember him calling me when then Supreme Court Justice Cornyn asked him to come and talk to the Texas Supreme Court and give some suggestions as to how they could streamline their system. He thought that was the biggest thing in the world. That was so great. Then, little did he know, then Justice Cornyn would eventually become Attorney General Cornyn and asked him to start become the first SG, and he calls me and asks me, what do I think? I said, that is a dream come true. And he does that. And did he do it? He was just phenomenal. Greg was, there was something that Judge Jones said about him at his memorial service that I went back to find, because I remember being struck then. She said, I would say that all the superlatives that have been said about Greg are true. How many of us can say that? That you go to, that people who know you will be able to say the best things about you, and they're all true. So that is, he would embody, he would, wouldn't he be a phenomenal judge? Wouldn't he, any job, governor, judge, president, he would just be phenomenal, because there was something about him. There's the, I was asking a friend this week, what was the, what happened to the word honor and honorable? And the reason I was thinking of that word is because I was beginning, I was trying to think of a word that captured Greg. And I would have to say honorable. Not honorable in the sense of the honorific that we get when we become judges or public officials. That's just a title. But honorable. He was, the people talk about him, and they talk about the fact that Judge Jones said in her memorial service, there was a decency, there was a kindness, there was an honesty, there was a quiet tenacity, there was an unassuming conscientiousness and courageousness. He didn't tell you he was number two in his class at the law school. What he asked me to do, he asked for one favor from me during his clerkship. Would you interview my classmate, Patrick O'Daniel? It's the only thing he ever asked me for. And anybody that knows Patrick, Patrick has a New York accent. Patrick O'Daniel. But that was the Greg was, that's the decency. So I asked someone, his co-clerks will tell you he never had an unkind word to say about even those you should say unkind things about.
Well, let's move then to some of the issues that the court deals with and that we all think about as lawyers devoted to the rule of law and the Constitution. You spent a fair amount of time in recent years, I think, looking pretty intently at the nature of the administrative state, in particular some of the issues regarding reviewability of administrative action and delegation of power to administrative agencies. What motivated you to begin to look so intently at this and almost to sort of try to use your opinions as an opportunity to encourage people both on the bench and off to do the same?
You know, Judge Jim Ho, when he was clerking, at the very end of his clerkship, he said something that was really interesting that I kind of hold on to. He said, you know, when I came to this job, I thought it was going to be very complicated and nuanced and difficult. He said, but you know, it's pretty straightforward, isn't it? And I think it is, if you start the right place. The thing that the Constitution, our construct, was to preserve individual liberty. You had separation of powers. You had federalism, enumerated powers. But there was a purpose to it. It wasn't just randomly picked. And when you start with the notion, if you read Justice Scalia's really interesting opinions on separation of powers, you always see the North Star or the lodestone or the central point in there, individual liberty. Like this, I'm going through all of these things about appointment clause or anything else, separation of powers, federalism, et cetera, for one purpose, to preserve this thing called individual liberty. So when you start with that and you look at what we have allowed to develop around us, the administrative state, you begin to say, how does that compromise the separation, these structural protections for individual liberty. And it's not reviewable. It has its own separate system of executive powers, of legislative powers, and of judicial powers. And then the courts are deferring to them under Chevron or Auer or Seminole Rock. So now you've got this problem that you've got this parallel system that's almost like the royal courts that are independent of the separated judicial system. Well, I remember talking with Justice Scalia a lot and just saying that that is circumventing our structural protections. And so that's what got us started. And as we dug more into, over time, the implications of this, for example, we got to the point where we were deferring to positions by agencies in briefs before the court. Well, then what kind of review is that? And the point, I think we reached a point where there were no protections. And I think with the central point being that we were looking to protect that core, that individual liberty, I think we began to work backwards. And that's what, if you look at the opinions, they all raise questions about Chevron, about Auer. And the final point I'd make about that is we followed in some of the opinion, I forget which of my opinion, the logic all the way to the precipice. We looked over and we said, oh my goodness, there's no there there. And that's when you begin to walk back.
You also looked way back, right? I mean, I remember that around the time some of those big opinions came out where you touched on these issues, Magna Carta was in Washington. And
well, that's because you brought it there.
Well, the Federalist Society, I didn't bring it there. But for the first time in quite a while, we started seeing references to that charter. And
We had always, it's really interesting. We had A.E. Dick Howard had written a small piece, sort of an explanation of from University of Virginia Law School about on the 350th anniversary of Magna Carta. And my law clerks I've got quite a number of my former law clerks here. And
Make them stand up.
Would my former law clerks and please stand? Thank you all. But there's a fascination about going back. They are intellectually curious. Judge Jones talked about Greg being intellectually curious. All of them are. And so we go back and look at these things, and Magna Carta is where it begins. That's the beginning. And the whole point is to, again, if your whole notion is to protect and reassert individual liberty, where else would you start? But the sort of the first in our legal tradition, the first assertion of that.
One person asked, what cultural ideas or cultural experiences might have influenced you to start thinking about the direction of your judicial philosophy? Were there things in your life that kind of informed you about that?
I think it was segregation. When you live in a system where the government tells you you can't walk across a park, you can't drink out of a particular water fountain, you can't vote, you can't do this, that begins you thinking, certainly for me in the 60s, you can't go to a certain library, you can't go to a certain school. You begin to think about the use and misuse of governmental power. And I'm just a kid. So the first I began to do that was actually as I actually became more acclimated to reading in the 60s, and that led me to reading Ayn Rand. So I'm not saying I understood Ayn Rand, but I started peeling that onion. So I read Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged back in high school. And there were other books that I read, but I would say that. And I also grew up in a house of a fiercely independent man, my grandfather, who I still think is the greatest man that I know anything of. And he yearned to have the benefits of freedom and liberty as we see it. And yet he didn't have it. But even within that society that imposed these restrictions, he sought to be independent, to be as far away from those who could exert control over him as possible. So he would never work for anybody. And we farmed. We were sort of, I would say we were off the grid, but we were never on the grid. So, I mean, it's kind of hard to say you're off the grid when you're never on the grid, but we were a grid-free zone. And so we lived in one of these houses that when the hurricanes came, and which they often did, and they would knock out power for like 3 or 4 weeks at a time. And but when you live as we did, you never missed it because it was only one light bulb. But he was, I would say, my grandparents and the environment I grew up in, where your government is imposing authority over you, and people are seeking to be independent of that.
You know, you mentioned your grandfather and the great affection and admiration you had for him. The other person later in your life who you seemed to develop a great relationship with was Justice Scalia. Do you have any particularly fond memories of your time with him on the court?
Oh God, we had a hoot. So when I arrived, he said, "You know, Clarence, I was thinking that when a new member of the court came along who was more conservative than I was going to leave. But I think I'm going to hang around." Oh, gosh, we had a blast. I always told him, "Look, I'll set the edge, and you can run to the inside of me, you know?" So my job was to make him look moderate.
Well, and speaking of which, one person asked about the doctrine of stare decisis, and that's one area where the two of you sort of charted slightly different courses for a period of time. Tell us a little bit about your views in that area and
you know, I think people use rules. I mean, people will overstate rules, that they'll throw out stare decisis. So I just said, "What is it? What exactly is it, and to what does it apply? Does it apply differently under unwritten common law versus written law? A written constitution versus an unwritten constitution?" The English legal tradition grew out of an unwritten tradition. Stare decisis makes sense. Does it apply to the absurd? If something is totally absurd, does it lock down the rules? I thought the best explanation of what was going on was by Justice Goldberg. Like he wrote a book after he left the I think the UN, and of course he was off the court by then, where he said that you apply stare decisis very loosely when you want to change law in the direction you want it to go. And once you have that in place, you apply it very strictly to retain it. And he said that way it has a ratcheting effect. I think that's a bit of what's going on. That I've read Caleb's work. I've gone back and taught a course on it. I've gone back to Blackstone. What we've tried to do is to understand it throughout the English tradition. And I think actually the people like Blackstone would be astonished that when you have written law, that we are actually applying stare decisis the way we are, instead of just referring back to what is written. But what separated us is, I think that unfortunately, if you accept the premise in some of these cases, that is it. That leads you inexorably to conclusions that are antithetical, I think, to the Constitution and to certain statutes.
One area where I think some people who submitted questions mentioned you wrote about recently was the issue of of nationwide injunctions. Mm-hmm. And we hadn't seen a good excursion into that topic at the High Court for a long time. Can you talk a little bit about what motivated you to focus so much attention on it? And
well, I mean, it's just as most things on the court, it's a simple question. I just ask my clerks, where does this come from? I mean, doesn't that encourage form shopping? Where does it come from? Where does a judge get to have jurisdiction beyond? There's some cases where just by the very nature of the law involved, the federal law involved, that if one judge enjoins it, it will have a nationwide effect. I understand that. But when there are some instances when you can localize the effect of what you're doing, as to this, these plaintiffs, it is enjoined. So I just simply wanted to know, where do you draw that line, and why is it that one judge can enjoin nationwide a federal policy before it's implemented? And so it was mostly that. And I think sometimes, and again, it goes back to the stare decisis point, we reflexively continue down a road without slowing down and asking, what is the basis of this? I didn't have an axe to grind. It's like when I came on the court, where did this come from? Think of all the things that we reflexively go along with. All this terminology, evolving standard of decency, like expectation of privacy. Where does this stuff come from? And so what I do with my clerks is I try to figure it out. If it has a legitimate basis, so be it. But if it's just something that somebody's regurgitating and unexplained, I don't think we should. By the way, the expectations of privacy comes from somebody having a quick idea before an oral argument in the middle of the night. That's where that comes from. And suddenly it's in our jurisprudence in CATS, and it stays in our jurisprudence. And I'm not saying I agree with it. Well, actually, I do disagree with it. But it is not well thought out. It's just someone thought it up. And I don't think, particularly as judges, and I think we who are trying to, who believe in liberty, we are obligated to do more than simply reflexively go along with these things. If you go back and you take a look at some of the cases that Greg argued, it was as though, I remember when he was having his firms was giving him a hard time about what he was doing. He wasn't out, you all know Greg. He wasn't upset with the world. But if something was unprincipled, someone had to assert it. You know, I remember him arguing at the court, and Justice Ginsburg would go after him. He would just calmly, now, Justice Ginsburg, as you said, and he would just go through it. You can't be mad with a guy who every time you come out with something sharp, he takes the edges off of it. And he just points out, but where does that come from? And that's all we're doing. We're just simply asking people to justify what we are doing to our fellow citizens. Instead of saying stare decisis, we should say quo warranto, by what authority? We should always ask that.
Great. I mean, the next question is going to be a little technical, but yeah. I'm surprised quite a number of people put in note cards about it, so I'm going to ask it. Commentators have suggested that you've evolved on the doctrine of severability. You have any thoughts on that?
I have no idea. I mean, whatever.
Moving on. I'm glad we put that one to rest.
So here's what happens. People think we're not automatons. We're not robots. We are judges. Judge Jones and I, she's been doing this job over 3 decades. I have been doing it for almost 3 decades. You sit in your office, and what did she just say? The law. It becomes a part of your life. You see it. You start out, you're running as fast as you can. You're deciding cases. You're reading the precedent. As time goes on, it's like climbing a mountain. You're at the base early on. You're climbing as hard as you can. You see nothing but the mountain in front of you. But as you get closer to the top, those of you who are mountain climbers, not me, you have a panoramic view. You see the implications. You see the nuances. You see the permutations. You see the inconsistencies. So you start out doing the big things. And then you say, but there's all these other problems. You own houses. You start out, if you have an older house, you deal with this. I've watched HGTV. It's always in the walls. You always have structure. It's always foundations. And then the plumbing goes bad. And then you got to do rewiring because it has all this old wire. But once you get all the big stuff done, you start, now you can do this and this and this and that. And that's what you do. Now we're on the severability. You've thought about it all. It just basically means that's next. You've done these structures. You've done the administrative state. You can't do it all one time, but you can do it a piece at a time. And as you think more about these things, you read more articles, more cases, you see the inconsistencies, you see the problems. Well, remember, I'll tell you where I evolved. If you go back, what is it? We had the Sixth Amendment stuff.
Yeah.
Even administrative state stuff on Chevron deference. I didn't start out with any axe to grind. You follow the precedent. Well, what about forfeiture? What about a dormant commerce clause? I mean, I wrote some of the early, I think a couple of the early garbage opinions. And then you say, oh boy, what is this? Garbage is commerce. This garbage is garbage. Garbage in, garbage out. But it's just really, you start thinking about it. Then I wrote Camp Newfound and said, where does this come from? So you apply it. You do what you're supposed to do. You go along with stare decisis, and then you back up and you say, I don't know where this comes from. You think about it. That's all. I'm not evolving. I'm doing what judges are supposed to do. You dig into things and you have second thoughts about it and you think about it.
You hear a lot of talk, particularly during confirmation cycles for the court, about preserving the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. What do you think about that kind of a question? And what really, in your view, preserves the legitimacy of our court in this country?
First, I have no idea what they're talking about. I think what preserves all of our legitimacy, and is what we were talking about with Greg Coleman, that we do our jobs honestly, we do it with integrity, we do it with an ethical foundation, a moral foundation, we follow the law, we live up to the oaths that we take. And I think brick by brick, we build the structure and fabric of a society. Not one of us can tear it down or build it up by ourselves. But you just think about it. How many people can you use in leadership positions today? The word that I used about Greg, honorable. Honorable, not the honorable. Honorable. If we could use that word about more people who are in public life, people who actually ask the questions at confirmation hearings, instead of Spartacus, we use.
Had to get that in there.
Hey, look, 300, but at any rate. if we could use the word honorable more often, think about the difference it'll make. Then you'll have a legacy. We will have left the country in better shape morally structurally than we found it. But as long as we're looking at our interests or scoring points or looking cute or being on TV or the greenhouse effect or what editorials we're getting, especially the legal system, how do we maintain it? If you can't debate hard issues honestly, with honor, with integrity, how do we keep a civil society?
So basically just trying to get it right. I mean,
every day, doing our honest best. One of the things I say to my law clerks, and you can ask, I mean, you can ask any of them, they don't have any axe to grind. One of the promises I make them is this, that they will leave the job with clean hands, clean hearts, and clear consciences. That the only thing they have to keep are confidences, not deep, dark secrets. And you could have asked, there was in this, what a wonderful young man. So Greg asked me to, to speak to a reporter who had done a piece for him, on him in one of the Texas magazines. That's shortly before he passed away. And he was in town to be mooted for what would be his final argument. And we happened to have one of the former clerk lunches. Leonard is also one of my adopted former clerks. And we were at Capitol Grill in that back room, and he came next to me, and he kneeled next to me on the floor, one knee, and he thanked me for saying such nice things about him in that magazine. That was our final conversation. I think that if we are to emulate a young man, if we emulate that, him, we would all be better off. I think if we had his decency, that if we had his humility, his work ethic, his ability, his willingness to take on challenges, and his courage, we would be better off instead of all this grandstanding that you see out here on TV and scoring of points and little zaps here and little hits there. Think about imagine this. What if he were the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee? How would he treat someone like an Elena Kagan or even a Sonia Sotomayor? How decent he would be. How kind. What kind of integrity would he have? That is what we need in our society. And I would dare say Greg Coleman should be our model, and we'd be a better country for him.
Final question. What is the best part of your job?
Let me just say, my wife, Virginia, and I went there when she was 34 years old. I was 43. And we often look at each other. My wife, Virginia, is right here. She was a lady who walked out on me. Stand up, Virginia.
You have to stay for this part. You have to stay for this part.
But we often look at each other and high-five, and we've had a total blast. We have had a good life together. We've had some challenges, but we've had an opportunity to be a part of this country at a very high level and to do all sorts of things and to perhaps model what we think is the best way, a principled way, to go about our business. We always say it's been a hoot. And being married to her has been a hoot. It's 31 years. I am a man of peace. My wife she gets in trouble from time to time. Trouble finds me. I don't know. I don't know why. I'm minding my business and trouble finds me. But the best part of the job for both of us is our clerk family. We have had a blast. And the ambassador to that family is Stephanie Coleman. She has organized two absolutely fabulous clerk reunions. We had another one. You were there in Utah this summer in Park City. We had almost 300 clerks, former clerks, their families, incoming clerks and their families, and we had a blast for a couple of days. She's pulled the family together, so you have a directory and people know each other and look out for each other. But the best part is spending time with my clerks while they're clerking and watching them grow. And I mean, think about it, watching Greg leave. I remember he comes to me, he'd been offered, like so many of these kids, when they finish clerking, the big firms offer them jobs and try to attract them and stay in DC. I said, look, Stephanie wants you in Texas. If I were you, I would go back to Texas, buddy. But to watch his career, to watch your career, to watch all my kids here, to watch Allison Ho is another one of my adopted clerks. I mean, just watching all of you do things, that's the joy. And to see you raise your families, to see the ups and downs, to be a part of it, to see you all look out for each other, and to see you stand up and do the right thing. The joy I got out of Greg's career, and I think Judge Jones would agree with me, it's like twice joyful, dude, having worked with you and then watching you the rest of our lives. So the clerks are the best part of the job.
Well, that's a great way to end the conversation, because one, it reminds us all of Greg and his great family. And secondly, it reminds all of us of the tremendous contribution you've made to this country. Not only what you've done on the court in terms of your opinions and so forth, but also in terms of the mentor relationship you've had with so many of your law clerks who are going on to be great public servants and leaders for our legal culture for the future. So with that, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard. And, thank you all.
Now I'm going to call up to the dais April Farris. April is a partner at Yetter Coleman, Gray Coleman's law firm, and she knew Gray Coleman quite some time ago. If I remember correctly, she summered form at one point, and then ultimately became a member of the firm. And so, April, I'm going to call you up to what is going to be a podium in a moment, and then we'll have a presentation from you. Thank you.
Good afternoon. We have a few little adjustments up here before we present our awards today. I am deeply honored to represent Yetter Coleman in this very special tribute to Greg Coleman's legacy. Yetter Coleman was Greg's firm, and we are very proud to bear his name. In his memorial service remarks in 2010, Paul Yetter described Greg Coleman as a planter of seeds of professional excellence, seeds of courage, seeds of honor, and seeds of perseverance. Greg planted these seeds both at home and in his profession. Today, 8 years later, we can all see that those seeds are in full bloom. You've heard that the Coleman family is a testament to Greg's spirit and resilience. Stephanie is an inspiration to all of those who know her. Greg's sons, Chase, Austin, and Reed, are all distinguished men of good character. Reed is now following in Greg's footsteps as a law student at the University of Texas. Meanwhile, Greg's law firm, Yetter Coleman, is going strong. Greg's character, skill, and work ethic are forever ingrained in our firm culture. Now, the Federalist Society also held a very special place in Greg's heart. Every year, Greg would present the U.S. Supreme Court update for Federalist Society chapters across the state. Now, between his expert analysis of cases, very many of which he argued himself, Greg would ask the audience challenging questions about American history and early Supreme Court precedents. Now, if you answered that question correctly, you would receive a large, delicious Cheesecake Factory cheesecake. These cheesecakes eventually became the stuff of legend. And having earned a Greg Coleman Supreme Court update cheesecake was a true mark of distinction for any Texas attorney. Now, the Federalist Society today has created a plaque commemorating this inaugural Gregory S. Coleman Memorial Lecture. The plaques bear the logo of the Federalist Society and the state seal of Texas. Texas's Secretary of State approved our use of the state seal in recognition of Greg's significant contributions as Texas's very first Solicitor General. On behalf of the Texas chapters of the Federalist Society and the hosting Fort Worth chapter, it is my honor and privilege to present these plaques to Justice Thomas and the Coleman family. Thank you very much.
And before everybody leaves the stage, to forever remind Justice Thomas where he was when we inaugurated this first lecture series, the Fort Worth chapter has a separate gift for you, Justice Thomas. It is a Fort Worth Stockyards belt buckle that will always remind him that he was in Fort Worth when we inaugurated this lecture honoring his good friend, Greg Coleman. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's as Texan as we could do it.
This is really, I'll put this with my bodacious buckle.
Our next panel will begin shortly. It'll be back in the original room where we started. So let's take about a 5-10 minute break and we'll reconvene in the original conference room. Thank you.